The top Republican in the Illinois House of Representatives says it's time for lawmakers to get back to work in the state capitol.
We have a responsibility that doesn't go away because of this emergency situation that we are living in.
An interview with House Minority Leader Jim Durkin. Plus, despite the thousands of COVID-19 cases tied to meat processing plants nationally, President Trump has ordered them to remain open. Today, one of the largest such plants in central Illinois is reporting more than 45 confirmed cases of the disease. And climate change is pushing America's so-called Tornado Alley into parts of Illinois. We'll talk to a researcher who says tornadoes here might become more frequent and more severe. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Dr. Ngozi Ezike, a pediatrician and the director of the state's Department of Public Health, typically joins the governor's daily news conferences to give the numbers update on the spread of the coronavirus disease. She did that yesterday afternoon, a couple thousand new cases in our terrible new normal, and 176 more deaths, Illinois' highest single-day total yet. But Ezike did not stop with the numbers update. She went on to acknowledge a feeling that many of us seem to be experiencing as we begin to lose count of how many weeks we've been staying at home. How many weeks we've been living in this disrupted reality.
I know that May has signaled a change, not only a change in the calendar month, not only a change in the weather, the season, but also a change in some people's psyche. The change has highlighted an increased sense of cabin fever and the desire to get out and get back to what people perceive as what their previous normal was, and wanting that back so much. There's so much pressure for us to get back to that normal because we have all faced this unprecedented disruption to our lives.
But the truth, Ezike said, is that we are still deep in our war with the novel coronavirus.
If this was a traditional war where there were soldiers outside of our doors in the streets and people would be risking their lives to be outside of their homes, no one would think about the need to go to work. No one would think about getting their dog groomed. No one would think about getting their car washed. But this enemy is so different. It's invisible. And maybe as a result of that, we have underestimated the power and the destruction of this enemy, despite the very visible fact that more than 2,500 Illinoisans have lost their lives in just 2 months. That's an unprecedented amount of lives lost compared to any time within our Illinois history.
Because of that, Ezike said, Illinoisans must remain as vigilant as they were when the threat of the novel coronavirus seemed more novel and less routine. But in a sort of bad cop, good cop routine, Governor J.B. Pritzker followed Ezike with a vision for the future. It's a plan he's calling Restore Illinois, and it imagines 5 phases of living with COVID-19. As different parts of the state see consistent declines in cases, life can slowly return to some shadow of what we consider normal. For now, that leaves us in phase 2. Restaurants and barber shops are still closed, but hiking and golfing and boating are allowed, with limits and social distancing. Restaurants and schools and daycare centers don't come back until phase 4, although still with social distancing and all of us wearing face coverings out in public. And life doesn't really get back to anything resembling normal until we have victory over the coronavirus.
I know that we all have a passionate desire to return to the sense of normalcy that we felt before the world knew of COVID-19. Here's the truth, and I don't like it any more than you do. Until we have a vaccine or an effective treatment or enough widespread immunity that new cases fail to materialize, the option of returning to normalcy doesn't exist.
As we go to air Wednesday morning, Republicans from the Illinois House of Representatives are scheduled to hold a news conference, over Zoom, of course, calling for members of the Illinois General Assembly to return to the Capitol building and get to work. Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hi there. Oh, that's so much better.
Okay.
Jim Durkin is a Republican state representative from Western Springs in the Chicago suburbs. He's also the House Minority Leader. I called him up yesterday afternoon. We spoke by FaceTime. So am I on speakerphone or how?
Yeah, you want him off speaker?
If you can just hold the phone up to your ear like it's an actual phone, that tends to get the best sound.
All right, this one.
Our conversation covered that call for a return to session, the state's disastrous budget situation, and divisions within his own House Republican caucus about how quickly to reopen Illinois. But I began by asking him what he thought of the governor's plan to gradually reopen.
You know what? I'm still absorbing it. From first glance, it gives even more authority unchecked to the executive branch. So I'm looking at my role, my constitutional authority, the oath of office that I took, and I'm trying to figure out where it plays into that this report that came out today. So I can't get into specifics, and it's something that my staff and I are really going to be digging into. But at first glance, that's what I see.
It seems we're all in phase two now, right? And I assume you've seen at least the summary. That means restaurants can still only do carryout or delivery. Non-essential businesses can be doing curbside orders. People can go golfing or boating with social distancing.
That obviously was the modified executive order that came out at the beginning of the month,
which seemed to incorporate some of what you and other members of the House Republican caucus were calling for a few weeks
ago. That's correct.
Right?
It was memorialized in a document to the governor day before he issued his order, but it's something that I had stressed to him on a number of calls, not only with him personally, but also with the other legislative leaders about different aspects of life in Illinois for people and businesses who we felt can get back to doing some things that they had previously were accustomed to. And you know what, every day and every week, there is something new, but we also learn that we perhaps have gone too far in a certain area. Other situations need to be adjusted. And I think that that's a responsibility. At least I'm glad it's getting through. But I'm getting back to, again, I'm glad that the governor did recognize House Republican priorities in the modified order. But it does not speak to what exactly the role of the legislature is during this process. And that, to me, is concerning. It's concerning to Republicans. I know it's concerning to Democrats. And we have a place in this process. We have a constitutional role. We took the same oath of office as the governor did. So I just believe that not only is it just makes sense that when the legislature's under a roof, we're able to accomplish many things with the administration or without the administration. But we have a responsibility that doesn't go away because of this emergency situation that we are living in.
What is that responsibility?
We're the ones who pass laws. The governor can make recommendations. The legislature passes laws. And the governor, upon signing a law, his responsibilities under the Constitution is to execute the laws. But the legislature is the one who ultimately, this is where the process begins and how our state is to be managed, how it is supposed to run, whether it's with the daily lives of individuals or how our businesses, small and large, are to operate. So the responsibilities are equal. But in this period that we've watched this play out in the most unprecedented of times, we can't neglect the obligations of duly elected citizens who are part of state government. Washington and many other states have found ways to reconvene and to get their business done. We're a state that has serious problems, but the problems need to be addressed in a bipartisan manner, whether it's remotely, which we could do, or it's going to be somewhere in Springfield in a safe, healthy environment. And let me just stress that the Department of Public Health has already issued a report and set up the guidelines for the legislature to return back to session in a way which will not compromise the integrity of the health and safety of legislators and their staff.
Why hasn't the legislature come back to Springfield?
I can't speak for Mike Madigan. And I'm dumbfounded that he has not been more forthright with not only his members, but to the public. I have stated, and I've raised this about going back into session, and I hear little or nothing other than, you know, when it's safe, we'll go back. But, you know, we can learn from other states. We're adults. We can make decisions and we can operate in a safe, healthy environment. But every day and every week goes by, it just places more pressure upon the legislative body in doing their jobs. And to me, if we're setting ourselves up for a few days at the end of May to do a budget and to pass a few important issues that are at least important in the eyes of the Democrats, then we failed. We have absolutely failed.
I want to ask about what a spring session would look like. And it strikes me that with these working groups that are meeting, there is already sort of a shadow session going on. It's just not open to the public through normal committee hearings where people can actually see what legislators are discussing in open session. Does that strike you as a fair characterization?
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, I think if I'm open to having the public listen in on these working group meetings. I asked the speaker last month, I put the idea in his head that we should have our members discuss and talk through issues that are before them in their committees, matters that were important back at the beginning of the year and ones which are still important. I felt that it was necessary because I know history, is that oftentimes we, as it comes close to the middle of May or end of May, we are surprised or we're just kept out of the loop by the Democrats on the major issues. So if we're going to, and when we are going to return to Springfield, I want to make sure that our members are not going to be caught off guard. That is assuming that the Democrat legislators are being truthful and are being transparent about what their ideas are on the priorities of the session as we get closer to its closure.
What are your priorities for this session? What are the House Republican priorities for this session?
Setting aside the budget.
Well, we'll come back to the budget. That's obviously the big one. But yeah, what else?
Here's something is extremely important that has been lost because of the pandemic. Ethics reform. There was a commission that was created last year. A report was due. It has been extended, but with no clear date in mind for the Ethics Commission to render recommendations to the General Assembly, which means, again, this could be another situation where the Democrats will throw together some recommendations and say, take it or leave it in the last minute. Ethics reform is a priority. Property tax reform is a priority. One of the issues that has raised a great concern to a number of our members is how the Department of Corrections, through the governor's office, is now opening up the jail cells for a number of individuals. And we're not quite sure what the criteria that has been used to allow for early release of individuals. And also, I will say the concern is it's not low-level nonviolent offenders. We do know that people who have been convicted of extremely violent crimes, murder and rape, armed robbery, are being part of this process within the Department of Corrections of whether they're, I would just say, early release or other types of designations that they've given these individuals. We don't know whether or not, here's the most, I would say, more important that I'm hearing from prosecutors and also law enforcement. They're not given heads up. Victims aren't being given heads up that people who've committed these violent crimes have been released early from Department of Corrections. That's the whole point of having a constitutional victim's bill of rights. I would want to know if I'm the victim of a crime or if I've lost a loved one through a vicious murder of whether or not that offender is going to be back out in the street. I don't think that's happening.
Doesn't the governor have supreme authority to grant clemency and to release people if he wants to?
He can, but I do know that it doesn't. It does not trump the victim's Bill of Rights.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with House Republican Leader Jim Durkin, and we've been talking about things that the legislature might accomplish when it comes back. Before we get to the state budget, if the legislature comes in, you talked about Department of Public Health guidelines. There are a number of members of the legislature who are just like everyone else in population. There are older members. There are members who have pre-existing health conditions, you might say, that would make them more susceptible to this. How can the legislature do its work in a way that is transparent and open to the public and still ensure everyone's safety?
I will just say that there is not only a plan that was created by the governor's Department of Public Health, but there also is a common sense factor, too, that we've all been living by right now in our daily lives. But we all swore and took an oath of office that we would faithfully discharge our duties. If there is ever a time for the legislature to step up and get the job done, it's right now. There's issues that are going to, that we should address, whether it's going back and reforming our public pension systems that is going to have a huge strain on this year's budget. We're talking close to $10 billion. Are we going to ignore also this crudely but also offensively partisan redistricting process that we see every decade? There's a way to address that when you have a governor who opposes gerrymandered maps. But we should not let the Democrat majority off the hook. And if we are going to just wait it out until the end of May, that's what's going to happen. The important issues that have to be addressed, whether it's ethics, redistricting reform, pension reform, will just go away.
Let's talk about the state budget. You mentioned the $10 billion pension contribution that is obviously a large and growing share of the state's budget every year, but that doesn't even account for the massive investment losses that are probably happening this year from the pension systems on account of the economic crisis. And we just saw the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, as you know, the legislature's nonpartisan budget arm, announced that state revenues were down $2.7 billion. But the year had been going well, so that's only, and I say that with an air quote, only a net drop of $1 billion. But we know there's more to come.
Of course.
How do we begin to dig out of this?
You know how we begin to dig out of this is by meeting and exchanging ideas. And let me just give you an example.
Aren't the working groups doing that right now, though?
The working groups are, I'll just say that they are going through the issues. There are some discussions between our budgeteers, but there really has not been any meaningful or substantive recommendations that have been made. Last May, in short order, within a matter of 72 hours, we were able to negotiate and balance a budget, which was at one point unbalanced, but we were able to meet, talk, and we were able to exchange, I think, some very good ideas of how we can move forward with this budget, have it done in a balanced manner. I'll just say that when we meet and we exchange ideas, we physically meet and exchange ideas, we get things done.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The 21st. We're talking with Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin. Stay with us. More to come in a moment. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin. We were just before the break talking about the state budget. I want to wrap up, just a few more minutes left in our conversation, by talking about returning to talk about the governor's stay-at-home orders and the modifications they've been through. Some of those were with the input of you and the other members of the House Republican caucus, it seems. But we have seen other members of your caucus who are not satisfied even with those changes. Representatives Darren Bailey and John Cabello have filed separate lawsuits saying that the governor's stay-at-home orders violate their civil liberties. Do you agree with their position?
Let me just say this. When I took on this position, a few years back, what I felt was the most important statement and the most important guidance I can give my members is that I have to and I will respect the regional differences that we have within the state. Having run for a statewide office, it gave me a greater appreciation many years ago. It gave me a greater appreciation of the regional differences. Not only is it just regional, but it also is philosophical. I have members that are very conservative, but that reflects their district. Representative Bailey is a very principled, conservative Illinoisan, and he has a right to question the issue of the extension of the executive order, as does Representative Cabello. But I look at it that their region looks at this issue through a different lens than I do. There may be a handful of cases in Clay County. In my village where I live, there's almost 20 cases as we speak. There's close to 600 cases in my legislative district and multiple deaths. Everyone would like to get back to normal. But where I live and the people that I talk to, people respect the executive order. They respect that there has to be social distancing. and that there needs to be some type of oversight on activities that we take for normal, but we're all in the same position. I want to get back to what I, everybody wants to get back to where they were before this, but there is, I think, a different attitude in this area towards a stay-at-home order. And we're not getting into whether or not, and I'm not talking about whether or not this is violates the statutes of Illinois, but the attitude in my areas and also in Cook County, you'll see it everywhere. Everybody's wearing a mask. People are more than cautious about food deliveries, of talking to people on the street. So it's up here where the cases are and where there has been, you know, we have super spreaders. We have cases that are still at a, raising at a high level in the suburbs and also the city of Chicago. So my view is going to be different than Representative Bailey's view, but I understand that. I understand that his district looks at it differently because they don't see it. In my district, it's real. It's just not as, it's not pervasive. All they see are businesses that have been shut down without seeing this virus reaching their parts of the state.
I know you said you're still processing what the governor's Restore Illinois plan, so-called Restore Illinois plan, is going to say, but it does have this regional approach. Do you think that's the right way to go?
I think it's a way of looking at it, and it's always going to be in the way in which there's implementation. I will say this, that I'm confused with the designation of health regions based on an EMS map. And I'm going to have to look at that more to see whether or not we should be reviewing the Henderson County under the same rules and process as we consider Peoria, because those are all under that, under the same health region. So I've got to make sense of that. And I hope it does make sense. And I hope it's just not for a visual for the moment. But with this plan, I've got about 12 pages in front of me. And will the citizens of Illinois accept it? I know that the people of Illinois are reasonable, and they're willing to give government some respect when it comes to these decisions. But the plan has to make sense. And, you know, it's still early to determine whether or not what the governor has laid out today is something that we feel is, one, going to, you know, bring at least some comfort to people throughout the state of Illinois that we do have a plan in place, and two, whether or not it's something that is actually, it's feasible and it can be executed on.
Jim Durkin is a Republican from Western Springs and is the minority leader of the Illinois House. Leader Durkin, thank you for taking the time to share your views.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Thank you.
A number of meat processing plants are facing backlash over their handling of the pandemic. Several facilities across the U.S. have become hotspots for the coronavirus.
In our area, that means a return to operations at the Smithfield plant in St. Charles. It was ordered to shut down by the Kane County Health Department last week due to an outbreak of COVID-19 among an undisclosed number of workers.
Smithfield will also suspend operations at its Monmouth, Illinois facility next week. This after the company says a small portion of employees tested positive for the virus.
More than 160 meatpacking plants nationwide have had coronavirus outbreaks, sickening at least 9,400 people, primarily workers. Plants here in Illinois have not been spared. As of yesterday, the Rantoul Foods, that's about 20 minutes north of Champaign-Urbana, they had 47 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Now, reporting from the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting suggests the plant came under scrutiny from health officials back in March. That was before the plant was cited for being more than 90% out of compliance with infection control practices last week. For more on this, we're joined now by Pam Dempsey. She's executive director for the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Pam, glad to have you back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So before we get into the latest numbers, the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting has been looking at conditions for worker processing plants since before the coronavirus pandemic began. Can you briefly walk us through some of the issues that existed before this outbreak?
Sure, and I cannot speak directly to Ranch Hill Foods directly, but based on our past reporting, generally workers face several challenges in these plants. You know, they work very closely together. Sometimes they have lack of bathroom access or lack of time to take restroom breaks. On-the-job injuries such as cuts and amputations are fairly frequent. A 2017 federal report found that one worker had suffered with a hurt wrist for weeks. She went to a company doctor who told her nothing was wrong, and then a non-company doctor found a fracture. Often workers are afraid to report injuries for fear of retaliation or retribution. So it's not always pleasant working conditions.
And what does it actually look like physically being, if you were to look at, I mean, are they, you know, do they have room to social distance when they're working? What does it actually physically look like in the plant?
It depends on the job. Generally speaking, you have tight quarters, you have shoulder to shoulder, work. You have something, you might hear this a lot about line speeds. So when a company increases its line speeds, workers are more packed more tightly to get the job done. In April alone, based on some of our other reporting, the USDA had approved 14 permits for meat processing companies to increase line processing speeds. So there's not a lot of room for social distancing generally.
So can you tell us more about Rantoul as a community? Does Rantoul Foods employ a lot of people?
Sure, definitely. Rantoul is a very diverse farming community, small town. It's also home to the Half Century of Progress show, which is acres and acres of tractors and farmers and thousands of people. And a good sense of community there. Rantoul Foods itself employs about 650 people, workers, including temporary workers. And those numbers were good as of Monday.
And is that, I understand, is it mostly an immigrant population that works there or?
No, that I couldn't say. I mean, But certainly Rantoul has its share of immigrant population. We've done some past reporting. You'll see migrants working in the fields, usually depending on planting spring and summer.
Okay. So what is the latest number of confirmed COVID-19 cases at Rantoul Foods?
So as you said, as of last night, there were 47 confirmed cases of workers at the plant. Though they are constantly testing, and because Carl locally is doing, testing of these swabs, the health department is getting confirmations back within 24 hours. No doubt we're expecting to see this increase, health officials have said. The first case was identified April 25th. Plant officials say that worker has recovered and is back to work. The following weekend, though, this past weekend, we saw 20 additional cases, and that was reported on Monday. I'm sorry. So there was, 22 cases. And health officials do expect to see a lot more. What they're seeing, though, is they're testing workers and then doing, if there's positive, they're doing contact tracing to see who the worker's been in contact with, who they live with, and, quarantines and then goes from there. There will be a mass testing event at the plant on Thursday and Friday.
Okay. And so it seems like the case numbers are, or at least have been, ramping up quickly there. Yeah, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, according to your recent reporting, Rantoul Foods came under health department scrutiny back in March. That's before it was cited for being more than 90% out of compliance with infection control practices last week. What do we know about that? Do we know if the plant has made changes to their cleaning procedures?
Yes, definitely. So the plant now, according to health officials and plant officials, is in full compliance with state requirements. So they have done things like more frequent sanitization of common areas, restrooms, lockers. They're doing that at least three times a day. They're doing health screening. So when workers come to work, they're, checking for temperature, doing a basic health screen. They're also, which I thought was pretty surprising, they have cut their own line processing speeds down by half. They wouldn't say specifically what that looks like, but they've reduced their line processing speeds to allow more distancing between workers. And then finally, they're allowing workers to take time off regardless if they are sick or not. If they don't afraid to come to work, they don't have to report to work, and they will not be penalized for doing so.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Pam Dempsey. She's executive director of the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. We've been talking about the dozens of confirmed COVID-19 cases at Rantoul Foods in central Illinois. And I want to mention, we did reach out to Jerry Jacobson, invited him to join the program today. He's director of human resources for Rantoul Foods. He declined our invitation, but in a statement said in part, that the plant is providing additional personal protective equipment and more hand washing stations for all employees, communicating crucial information to our employees in multiple languages, increasing our already rigorous sanitation procedures, increasing social distancing by adding common area space, and dramatically slowing production. The statement also says the plant has implemented a mass thermal scanning system to check employees' temperatures as they come to work and instruct employees not to report to work if they are sick or exhibiting COVID-19 symptoms. Pam, what else have we heard from the plant about what they're doing to address this?
That sums up. Mr. Jacobson has been reporting the same things out during our interviews. One thing they do tend to emphasize is that they say their very first priority are their workers. Without the workers, they say they won't have a business. Conversely, though, health officials have been in contact with them since March to take action now, take action ahead of what they were seeing or projecting as an outbreak. But at this point, they are in full compliance, and the company is emphasizing again and again its worker safety's top priority.
So, Pam, workers at Smithfield Foods have also been affected by the coronavirus pandemic. The company plans to reopen its hog slaughterhouse in Monmouth. That's about an hour west of Peoria. What have we seen there and around the state?
So, I could not speak directly to the Smithfield plant locally. I mean, if we're looking at mirroring what we've seen nationwide and the way the company has handled that, we've had a worker in South Dakota report that they were not given their safeties or their precautions. For example, he had asked to be screened for a fever. He wasn't feeling good. He was told he was fine enough to work, but chose to go home. Smithfield is also facing a lawsuit from anonymous workers who are not seeking any money. They just want better protection from the virus. So it's definitely an interesting thing, especially as we as a nation kind of grapple with our food supply. You saw before Trump's executive order to keep meat plants open, Tyson, I believe, had taken out large ads in newspapers in key states requesting that this is very vital and very a key part of our nation's food supply and to keep working.
You know, and this is, as you say, this is not just an Illinois issue. This is a national issue. And I think we've heard, at least 167 plants nationwide have had outbreaks. I mean, how quickly has this situation escalated nationally?
Yeah, no, it's we've definitely seen it ramp up for sure. So in reporting that we've done in collaboration with USA Today, part of that, we have tracked just the last 4 weeks now, a database that we're building, just tracking reports of meat processing workers who've become sick, who have passed away from this. And we've seen just recently, we topped yesterday 10,800 meat processing workers who have been confirmed sick with COVID. And that's at least we've seen those numbers rise drastically. And I believe based on our own reporting, nobody's expecting those numbers to stop. They're going to keep increasing.
OK, and what have we heard from state and federal leaders about these outbreaks?
So late last week, or 4 days ago, rather, Dick Durbin asked meat processors in Illinois, including Rantoul Foods, to make workers' safety a priority in the wake of President Trump's executive order. Of course, federally, you're seeing, Trump demanding these places stay open to keep working as considered essential businesses. So it's sort of a push-pull situation. You know, we need to keep food rolling, and yet these workers at these plants are susceptible to the spread, to the widespread of this virus. So it seems to be a bit of a conundrum, definitely.
And the last thing I want to ask you about, just a little more than a minute left in our conversation, but the number of cattle, hogs, and sheep slaughtered nationwide, I gather, is down more than 35% compared to the same time last year. That figures from the USDA. Pam, how are these outbreaks affecting the other end of production, namely farmers on the one side and then consumers on the other?
Certainly, farmers are getting little prices for their livestock. And with some of these plants shutting down, you've definitely seen reports of farmers having to kill their hogs or set their cattle out to pasture. And consumers are going to see higher prices in the grocery store. It's a bit inverse. Farmers aren't getting the money they definitely put into raising the livestock, and consumers will be paying more for meat, certainly here in the next, 6 weeks to 3-4 months.
Pam Dempsey is the executive director of the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Pam, thanks for being here and stay safe.
Thanks for having us. You too. Thank you.
Coming up after the break on the 21st, it is tornado season in Illinois. We'll be speaking with a meteorology professor from Northern Illinois University who says tornadoes could become more common in this area. And on tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about the connection between mental health and sleep, something that's been difficult for a lot of us during this pandemic. With our updated schedules and stress we're under, how are you coping? Or maybe have you been having some vivid stress dreams lately? We want you to share your thoughts with us. Send us an email, talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can also record a voice memo on your phone with a short message. And again, send that in an email, talk@21stshow.org. We might play it on air tomorrow. This is The 21st. More to come in a moment. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. When we think of tornadoes in the United States, images of the Southern Plains, or maybe Oklahoma, as depicted in the 1996 action thriller Twister, come to mind. But actually, Illinois was home to two of the worst tornadoes in U.S. history. The Tri-State Tornado of March 1925 left 695 people dead as it tore a path from Missouri across southern Illinois and into Indiana. And the Mattoon tornado in May 1917 killed 101 people in Illinois and injured hundreds more. Research from Northern Illinois University finds that tornadoes may become more severe and more frequent here in the state, especially as climate change pushes America's so-called Tornado Alley further north and further east into portions of Illinois, Indiana, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Victor Gensini is a professor of meteorology at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. He was lead author of the study on Tornado Alley and its movements, and he joins us now. Professor Gensini, welcome to the 21st.
It's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics here. What exactly is a tornado? Why is it that they only seem to occur in the United States, or at least that's where you hear about most of them occurring in the central United States?
So the sort of scientific definition of a tornado is just a violently rotating column of air that sort of descends from a thunderstorm and creates contact with the ground. And of course, if it doesn't touch the ground, then we call it a funnel cloud. And in the United States, we see about 1,300 of these tornadoes every year. And they're very common in the geographic area of the central plains of North America. Most continents, except for Antarctica, see tornadoes, and they're sort of most prevalent in the mid-latitudes, both in the northern and southern hemisphere. But the reason we see the sort of greatest amount of reports here in the Great Plains is that we have this mountain range to our west, of course, the Rocky Mountains, and then that close proximity to the Gulf of Mexico, which is the moisture source, sort of the fuel available for severe thunderstorms. So it creates sort of this atmospheric conditions are essentially very ripe in the central United States. And you do get hot spots in other areas of the world, like Australia. Argentina actually sees their fair share of severe thunderstorms and tornadoes every year. Places even like Bangladesh are hot spots for tornadoes. But by and large, central North America, the Great Plains, when you look back through history, sees the most number of tornadoes every year.
So how many, you mentioned how many tornadoes nationally, how many tornadoes occur in Illinois every season or every, you know, every year?
Yeah, we're generally up around 100. This year so far, we have 9 tornado reports. And of course, we're going into the peak of severe weather season here in Illinois. Illinois is a pretty big state. When you normalize for area, we're still usually in the top 10 in terms of counts of tornadoes every year when you look at all states.
And around this time last year, you predicted an outbreak of tornadoes in the U.S. that sort of came to be. By May 30th of 2019, there had been at least 225 tornadoes around the country in just a 12-day span. And before we get to how you were able to see that outbreak on the horizon, could you tell us, was it unusual to have that many tornadoes in the United States in May?
Well, May of 2019 was extraordinary in terms of tornado counts. I mean, usually you think of May as a very active period for tornadoes anyway, right? You're sort of in the peak of severe weather season. But we saw about three times the amount of reports that we would expect for that period. And so we started asking questions, right? Why did this happen? What was so anomalous about this May compared to Mays of the past? And that's what really sort of led us to dig into that study from a predictability standpoint. In fact, we, as you mentioned, we saw that particular two-week window in late May coming as many as 4 weeks in advance. And we think that there are certain things that are happening across the globe, sort of tea leaves, if you will, foreshadowing, that we understand at least right now that can set up either very favorable patterns for tornadic storms across the U.S. or perhaps relatively unfavorable patterns, sort of like what we're going through right now, which as we go into the weekend here, we're going to see very cold temperatures and cool, dry conditions across the Midwest and portions of the Northeast.
You know, I, it's interesting how far we've come with our ability to do forecasting. I was reading that more than 100 years ago, the word tornado was banned from U.S. weather forecasts because people didn't want to incite panic. But I mean, I think nowadays, when most of us think of forecasts, maybe because they picture that graphic on the TV news or their smartphone, you know, they think of a forecast as being something that can look a few days out. You know, maybe you can spot a storm coming in a couple of days, possibility of severe weather. But how can you know that an outbreak of tornadoes is possible weeks before it happens?
Well, it all starts with sort of background research and understanding what are the conditions present when these tornadic storms form. One of the things we know from research is that it's going to be very humid outside typically. So something that meteorologists measure called the dew point. When the dew point gets above certain value, we start to think, all right, there's a lot of moisture present in the atmosphere. And if there's a lot of moisture and humidity present, that's sort of the fuel that thunderstorms need. And you couple that with a couple other ingredients, one of them being vertical wind shear, which is looking for the jet stream, a source of lift to get the thunderstorms rising up towards the top of the lower atmosphere. And then this component of instability. In other words, if you get a cloud starting to rise like a hot air balloon, how unstable is that air mass? And so we kind of go back through history and we look at some of these older outbreak events. You mentioned the tri-state tornado, the Plainfield tornado comes to mind in 1990 across northeastern Illinois. And we kind of play forensics. We look for these conditions and we understand that, all right, when you get this certain present conditions, we can have at least the possibility of tornadoes to occur. And so it's sort of like playing crime scene investigation. Every time one of these severe weather outbreaks goes and happens, we go back and sort of do the forensics. We pull out the metrics and we now have things like artificial intelligence and machine learning that allow us to go back through these historical data sets and begin to mine them with great precision and accuracy to get better forecasts. And so you're exactly right. The thing that sort of falls out of this is that our forecasts for severe storms have gotten exponentially better in the last 25 years.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. We're speaking with Victor Gensini, professor of meteorology at Northern Illinois University. We're talking about tornadoes in Illinois. And if you have any questions or you want to share your thoughts with us, give us a call, 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. Given all the sort of bad news that we've been living with for a couple of months now, I'm reluctant to ask this question, but do you have any predictions for this May or the rest of tornado season in Illinois this year?
Well, it's not always this easy, but sometimes past performance in meteorology actually does say a lot about what's to come. And we've had a very, very active before coming on the show. And sorry about that. I think I lost you there. The April has been very, very active. And so we got, you know, it's like persistence, like forecasting the stock market. Do things continue to go up or down? And we use things like persistence in the long range forecasting, but we also use numerical weather prediction models. And we've had a very, very active April. We've had 73 fatalities so far this year, which is almost sort of the average count that we'd see for the entire year. Now we're in a really quiet period right now, but some of the forecasts that I'm looking at here coming up through the middle to the end of May look very active across the central Great Plains and even into portions possibly of Illinois and in the Midwest here by the time we get into mid to late May. So I'm afraid things are going to be quiet here for this week and maybe next week, and then perhaps really start to heat up as we go into the back half of May.
And so in general, taking a step back, are tornadoes becoming more common in Illinois?
Well, when you look at trends over the last 40 years, certainly the number of tornadoes that we've experienced in Illinois has gone up. And one of the questions becomes, well, is that a function of just more tornado reports, right? No tornado now goes unreported because we have things like cell phones and Doppler radar technology that just really don't allow for any tornadoes to slip through the cracks. But when you look at some of these other more objective measurements, like environmental conditions, for example, they actually do show a pretty marked increase in the tornado environments that we've had over the last 40 years. It's not a huge increase in that you may not know it from year to year, but when you look over a long time span, you can certainly see that increase. And I sort of liken it to a baseball analogy where you have maybe a 200 hitter and a 300 hitter. And if you're just casually watching baseball, you can't really tell the difference on a day-to-day basis of a 200 and a 300 hitter. But at the end of the season, we all agree that the 300 hitter is a better hitter. And when you apply that analogy to tornadoes, it's aggregating them over 30 or 40 year periods. And you can certainly see those upward trends that we've documented in that paper across places like Illinois.
And you've also looked at the idea of tornado alley sort of maybe shifting towards our region. Can you talk about where is Tornado Alley now and why should we maybe think of it including Illinois in the future?
Well, you know, Tornado Alley has generally been a media term, and I actually refrain
Sorry.
From using that as much as possible, right? Because I think Tornado Alley sort of eludes people to believe that when you close your eyes and think of tornadoes, you only think of them as happening in Texas and Oklahoma and Kansas. And of course, tornadoes can happen in all 50 states and really at any time of the year. And so when we kind of label these things like that, give them, terms like Tornado Alley, and certainly, you know, the highest density of tornadoes that happen every year are in that sort of central Great Plains of the United States. But I think it allows for some degree of complacency in the general public that they, begin to think that, Tornado Alley is not Illinois. I don't have to worry about these events. But of course, as you mentioned, again, in the start, we are not immune to these significant tornado events that happen across the Midwest. And so really what we've seen over the last 40 years is just an expansion of that greatest density of reports a little bit further to the east. And that becomes a huge deal for tornado vulnerability, because as you get east of the Mississippi River, the population density increases greatly. And in portions of the Mid-South, say Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, we have lots and lots of mobile homes. And that's where we see a significant amount of fatalities.
So the idea is you don't want people to be complacent, but I guess what I am hearing from you is that people should be thinking of Illinois, even if we don't use the term Tornado Alley, people should be thinking of Illinois as a place that has a significant amount of tornado danger, and that danger may be increasing in the future.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And of course, when you compare Illinois to other areas of the globe, it's when you're putting us up against Oklahoma and Texas, sure. You may not think we have as many tornadoes as them, and you'd be correct. But when you put us up against, say, Sweden, we probably have 50 to 20 times or 50 to 100 times the climatological risk that, say, Sweden or Finland does. So we see these events more frequent than perhaps other areas of the world. And we have to be ready for the next Plainfield or the next tri-state, because one thing that we know is happening is that our cities are continuing to get larger, and the bullseye on the dartboard for these tornadoes to hit has become larger, and we will see more frequent disasters in the future.
Just a little more than a minute left in our conversation. Speaking of cities, what should Illinois communities and just everyday people be doing to make sure that they are staying safe and are prepared for this potential increase in tornadoes?
Well, I think you got to have a plan, right? It all starts with a plan, and things like mitigation, of course, housing stock, building codes are all things that are important, but it really comes down to the local emergency manager for each county. And those EMs have to be accountable for having a plan, and many of them do. I actually personally know many of the EMs across Illinois, and I know they're doing a fantastic job. In fact, probably better than many other states. But when it comes down, it's still personal responsibility. Every person in their home, especially if you live in a mobile home, has to have a plan in place in case a tornado warning is issued for their area. It's really as simple as that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Victor Gensini is a professor of meteorology at Northern Illinois University, who's done some work on the increase in tornadoes that Illinois is likely going to be seeing in the coming years. Victor, Professor Gensini, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Yeah, this has been great. Thank you.
That is all the time we have for the 21st today. On tomorrow's show, we'll be talking about the connection between mental health and sleep, something that's been difficult for many of us during the pandemic with our new schedules and the stress we may be under. We want to know how you're coping or if you've been having some sort of crazy COVID dreams. Share your thoughts with us. Send an email to talk@21stshow.org, or even better yet, send us a voice memo using your smartphone. Again, that email is talk@21stshow.org. If you want a little tutorial on how to send a voice memo, you can find one on our Twitter page. Just search for 21ST Show. That's 21st Show. Our show is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.